Welcome back to the Laravel podcast. Today I'm interviewing Jeffrey Way, the creator of Laracast and one of the original, one of the OGs of Laravel. Stay tuned. All right, welcome back to the Laravel podcast. This is season three, and like I said, I'm not giving you crazy people episode numbers because I'm bad at counting. So this is the latest, whatever it is, episode of the Laravel podcast season three, and I've actually got one of our long-term recurring guests with me. I've got Jeffrey Way, the man, the legend, the creator of Laracast, and one of the significant popularizers of Laravel. Man, more than half of y'all, when you learn Laravel, you were learning it from this guy. But what I like about this season is that you might know about what he's taught you. A lot of people say, you know what, I listen to him every single day. I feel like I basically have a relationship with him at this point, but you might not know a lot about where he came from. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to sit down with Jeffrey for a little bit and kind of ask some questions about who he is and where he came from and wait. And Jeffrey, I have some things I already have queued up, but I'm also excited to see kind of what's going to come up as go. But first thing, top of the line, say hi to the people. And when you introduce yourself to someone new, not in our context, what do you tell people you do? I just want to hear your pitch.
My name is Jeffrey. I'm a web developer. I've been doing it for about 15 years at this point. I run a business called Laracast, which hopefully listeners of this podcast know. If not, it's dedicated to education, mostly in Laravel, but really just the Laravel developer. So it covers a lot of the ecosystem that we use, like Vue and Webpack and HTML and CSS. It's kind of for that type of developer. You know, lots of sites cover everything. You know, they cover Ruby and Python and PHP and Node, and it's like it ends up getting a little overwhelming because most people do have a focus.
Right.
So that's why I created Laracast.
Well, the interesting thing is it in some ways it's very focused, right? It's the video tutorial site for the Laravel world. But on the other hand, it's everything the Laravel developer needs. And so it's not just PHP, it's not just Laravel, right? You're covering front end, you're covering back end, you're covering process. It's got Git, it's got PHP Storm. That's what I love about it is that you say like it's not just Laravel, but it is for the Laravel developer. Everything that person needs. And I love that. I love that you gave yourself the freedom to like say, well, you know what, whatever. As a Laravel developer, I write CSS, then therefore Laracast can cover CSS.
Yeah, because really, I mean, as you know, Laravel ends up being a big piece of the puzzle, but really most of your time, you're trying to solve other problems. Yep. You're trying to figure out, oh, I screwed up this Git commit. How do I fix that? So, you know, it's Laravel is one piece of the puzzle, but there's countless pieces that we have to deal with every single day. So yeah, it tries to cover all of that.
I remember your talk a few years ago, I think it was at Laracon EU, where you went on that whole kind of prepared rant about all the things that you have to know to be a web developer today. Make sure to link that in the show notes.
You know, that ended up being the most popular presentation I've ever given.
I believe
on YouTube, it has 100,000 views or something. It's crazy.
That's awesome.
I've never had a presentation that popular.
So now that you heard that, you probably know that if you are listening to this podcast and by some crazy, crazy, crazy reason, you've never heard of Jeff or you've never heard of Laracast, everyone else is obviously already kind of giving credit to this, but I want to put my voice behind it. I have said for years, since long before I knew Jeffrey, before Laravel even existed, Jeffrey Way is one of the best teachers on the entire internet, period. If you are not subscribed to Laracast right now, go to laracast.com and subscribe. I promise you, you'll thank me for it. And when you said that thing about like, you know, what we have to learn, I'm actually onboarding a new developer to Titan as of this week. And she just graduated her computer science degree, but she's been learning Laravel and kind of doing this stuff on the side. And so I did one of our first pairing sessions where, you know, I know what her level of Laravel knowledge is. But this morning I was like, or last night I was like, oh, yeah, I guess you need to learn responsive web design and you need to learn what media queries are and what REMs and EMs are. Because, you know, I'd thought about all the Laravel stuff she needed to learn and not all this other stuff. I was like, okay, yeah, these things all together. So
it's crazy when you think about how much we have to learn. Like we all just agree to it too. Like why are we agreeing to this? It's so difficult. I look back and it's like for 10 or 15 years now, it's like every day I'm probably learning something new. That's why we have that joke that we all spend our days on Stack Overflow.
Right.
It's like every day you're presented with something where you're like, I don't know how to do this.
Yep.
You know? Yeah, it's a little overwhelming, but
a lot of us, honestly, the first time, and you, I'll tell a little story about this in a second, but a lot of us, the first thing we do when we have a problem is not go to Stack Overflow, but we go to Laircast and see if you've covered it. And it's funny because in our Telegram chat, sometimes somebody will be like, you know what, I need to learn this thing. Jeffrey, please go make a video about that so I don't have to learn it on my own. So... okay, so we're starting to get into code, and I promise you that was not what this is going to be about. So we are going to talk about Jeffrey. So here's what I know about your story, and I hope that this is going to give us an opportunity to figure out where to dig in. I know that your parents were composers and songwriters in Nashville or in the music industry in general. I know that before you were full-time in programming that you did, I'm guessing classical guitar, but I know it's basically professional guitar playing. And I know at some point you transitioned to web. I know that you did some web development teaching. You ended up at NutTuts, and eventually you split off and created Laircast. So that's like the high-level knowledge. There's so many spaces to fill in. So first of all, let's start out with growing up. My guess is that you grew up in a music family, and you were just into music at an early age. But is that actually true?
Yeah, it's pretty true.
Was it mainly guitar or...?
Well, when I was, I started playing guitar when I was about seven. My mom was...
Wow.
My parents divorced when I was five.
I'm sorry.
But my mom was... That's okay. But my mom was a professional songwriter in Nashville. So my earliest years I spent like in music studios. I remember like sometimes we'd be in the studio until midnight and I'd be passing out on
wow.
some couch while they were just at this huge recording setup. It was very fun in hindsight, but at the time, you know, you're a little kid, you don't think it's very cool.
Right.
When in fact, it's actually incredibly cool because this is where some of the most famous songs that ever have been recorded. But that's how I grew up. So of course, I got into guitar at a very young age. Both of my brothers played. So, you know, you just kind of follow in your siblings' footsteps. And that's what I did for a very, very long time. Like, I got hooked. I don't know what it is, but like for kids... You never know what it's going to be, but there's one thing that hooks them. Everything else they brush off. But then you'll find one or two things that they just latch onto. And guitar was that for me. I loved guitar and finding patterns. I thought that was the coolest thing with guitar. It's not like that with other instruments, but with guitar, there are patterns. There are shapes that you can play on the guitar. And you know, okay, if I've memorized this shape, if I move it up here, I can play that same shape in an entirely different key. And I always thought that was very cool. So that's what I did. All the way through middle school and high school and college, I had a music scholarship.
I mean, you're playing at 7 years old. I mean, I didn't even touch a guitar until I was in high school, and I never got very good. So was it very casual at seven, and it never got really kind of significant until college? Or, I mean, were you the type where people are like looking at you at 12 years old being like, what? You know, is that 12-year-old playing that right now?
I would sound like a jerk if I said yes. No, I mean, naturally, it starts off kind of slow. I'd learned how to play a few blues progressions and things like that. And then the older I got, the more serious I got about it.
Sure.
So by the time I got to college, it was 4 hours a day in practice rooms and doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It just hooked me. And then at some point after college, it left. I don't know what it is.
Huh.
I always worry about that with coding is just the obsession that I felt for guitar just left, completely left. I have a guitar right here I'm looking at, but I just don't even play it that much. It makes me sad, honestly, but that's just how it is.
I'm sorry to be fascinated by your sorrow, but I'm fascinated by this whole progression, but I want to go back just a second. So when you were talking about being in the studio with your mom while she was writing, I'm picturing, and I've watched way too many movies, but I'm picturing this, you know, mom working hard to put money, you know, put bread on the table, and she's working late nights and the kid's in the background doing his homework while he's like kind of laid out on some couch in some studio. I mean, am I getting the right vibe there, or am I
pretty
romanticizing
close.
It?
Yeah,
okay,
no, you can think of a dark room with a huge... recording setup and them playing the same track over and over. They play the track for 5 seconds. Whoop, made a mistake. Rewind it. Play it again. As they go through each layer, you know, the singer goes.
So she was a songwriter, but she was in the studio with the people who were actually recording it.
Yeah. So she would do demo. Like for songwriters, they write a song and then they'll go in the studio and do a demo.
Oh,
at least
okay.
This is how it works in Nashville. And then that demo will be shopped around to all of the labels for. You know, she was in Nashville, so it'd be shopped around to people like Shania Twain or Faith Hill or those types of people.
Would she sing the demo?
No.
Okay.
We'd get professionals to do it.
Okay.
And then I started playing guitar and I wanted to be the one playing.
Right.
Of course, I wasn't even remotely good enough, but, and my mom let me know that, which hurt my feelings significantly, but she was, of course, completely right. But in my head, I thought I should be the one in there playing guitar on this demo.
Yeah.
With 2 years experience.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
So were you, was your goal to be a studio musician or performance or just whatever came?
Of course I wanted to be like a rock star as a kid.
Okay.
But then as I started getting older, I started like figuring out my personality and I started realizing like, I'm probably not the personality type to go on tour and,
right.
and stuff like that. But I did like the idea of being a studio musician where it's like you have your day job and you go in and
yeah.
you do your work and then you go home and you can yeah. be with your family. Because I always thought like, even when I started dating my wife in college, and even then I was still focused on guitar a lot. And I was thinking to myself, like, do I want to go on tour and yeah. then just not be with her for 4 months out of the year? Because
yeah.
that ends up what happens if yeah. you're a touring musician. You leave for months at a time, you come back for a week, and then you're back on the road. And even then I was thinking, like, I don't want to be away from my girlfriend or my wife
yeah.
For long periods of time. So that's when I switched to being a studio musician, but I don't know. It just, whatever it was, completely left that obsession.
So
I think about it a lot, actually.
So it's not just the obsession that left, because it seems like even like the simple joy that comes from playing. I mean, because like, it wouldn't hurt you. You run your own business. You could take an hour and just go play right now and the whole thing wouldn't come crumbling down. But that's not even the first thing you'd do right now. So it seems, and mm-mm. maybe I'm reading wrong, but it's not just the obsession that's gone. Is it even the joy from playing?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I always think the things you love will come back. So I have right. this feeling when I'm older, it will come back. But mm-hmm. I don't know if it was because I was doing it from such a young age, so seriously for so long that I burned out. I feel
yeah,
like it's the guitar version of burnout. Like I completely burned out on it.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't fun anymore.
So, and this, I assume this was just a couple years out of college. So it was probably you had gone from it being the thing that you pursued on your own to all of a sudden a more structured thing. Or is that not a true characterization?
It was right in college when I kind of stopped. I was in, maybe it was this. I was in college on a music scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And in college, for whatever reason, it's like you don't go to college for to be a rock star. You know,
right.
like they're going to have you either playing jazz music or playing classical guitar. And there, it's like what's required of you is you go into a study room and you practice 4 hours a day to get the notes exactly right. Even at the time, I remember thinking, this isn't why I got into guitar. I didn't get into guitar to play this piece from the 1500s perfectly in front of a bunch of people while I'm wearing a suit. You know, like that's not why I got into it.
Yeah.
And I think that somewhat ruined it for me.
That's what I was wondering, whether it's the process of taking the thing that you loved, which is playing guitar on the songs you love in the way you want when it's your motivation to do it, and turning it into playing somebody else's music with pressure in context that you normally wouldn't choose, you know, with the structure and the pressure around it. And it's like some people say, like, I loved coding when it was my side thing, but once it became my full-time job, it kind of sucked the joy out of it.
Yeah, you hear about that a lot in tons of industries where it's like if you take your passion and then suddenly it's your job, it goes away. I've heard about that with photographers where it's like they love photography, but then suddenly they do it every day for a living and they grow to hate it. I worry about this with coding a lot, honestly. Like, will I get to the point where I hate it and I dread it every day? Do you think about that at all?
All the time. I think about it all the time because it's the same thing. I have had that happen before, and I can't believe I can't think of it right now, but I know that at least in some ways when I was doing some art, I had a little bit of the same experience. It was fun and it was creative, and when it became work and there's pressure to perform a creative act in a certain, you know, it was very difficult.
Right.
But for some reason with programming, I often tell people, like, at least for now, you know, I've been back into professional programming for 7 years, I think, at this point. I don't see any signs of it, right? I'm worried about it just like you are. But like, for me, every new day, there's just 100 things I could be doing that are fascinating to me. And I think maybe, we joke about the fact that there's so much pressure on us to learn all these things, but maybe mm-hmm. the fact that there's so much new, there's so much open, and there's even within that, there's so much choice for us about like what we want to pursue, that even though like we have to sit down and perform, if our jobs are healthy, I mean, your job is you get to pick what you're doing. My job is I give everybody 20% time. We have that breathing room to like go and explore and be fascinated, maybe like we were before it was a profession, that gives us a little bit of that breathing room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think about it sometimes with school, you know, like, when you force kids to learn, are you ruining it for them? You know,
right.
that's like that common discussion that goes back and forth. And it's like, it's got to be this hard, line to walk where it's like you need to encourage kids to learn these specific things, but if you push too hard, you're going to ruin it because you're going to ruin it for them.
Yeah,
I think about that a lot now that I have a daughter. I'm not sure how we're going to do that. I guess you have to present them with lots of choices, lots of things, and then just wait to see what they really latch on to.
Yeah, and really good teachers help make things fascinating. Like I think the best kind of teacher, whether it's in school or even like I'm trying to remember what it was, but I was listening to somebody talk about being a good podcast host. Like the best way to make something interesting is to be like curious and to invite kids along with this curiosity, right? Like to invite your learners along where you are helping basically infect them with like the desire to know more and the fascination. And so instead of like forcing you to learn this, you're developing within you like a curiosity and a fascination. And a lot, once you think about it that way, a lot of the best teachers use that language, but I don't know if that language would have clicked before, you know, we started thinking this way. It's the same thing for me. Once I had kids, I totally thought about learning in school a very different way. So
I agree, and it's contagious too. Who I think does this better than anyone is Neil deGrasse Tyson. Like, you don't even have to be interested in astrophysics but if you listen to him talk, just go on YouTube and find any presentation he gives, he's so passionate and so enthusiastic about it that he'll be talking about something so mundane and he will make it sound incredibly interesting. So sometimes I'll just go on YouTube and watch video after video of his because it's contagious.
Yeah.
It's really interesting stuff.
And it's interesting because it's a two-way thing. I think individual people can be so fascinated in maybe relatively uninteresting thing that they can, their fascination can be contagious. But I also think that we can develop within us like a curiosity and hopefully develop within other people a curiosity that makes otherwise boring things more interesting. Like I often have conversation, I'll meet somebody at a dinner party or something like that, and my wife will make fun of me because I'll meet this new person I've never met before who doesn't seem that interesting, but they are very interested in something, and they might not have the Neil deGrasse Tyson in them to make it sound interesting, but I can like spend an hour with them and like be fascinated by, you know, I remember meeting this guy who at first was just very like neckbeardy, judgy, makes everybody else feel dumb. But I was like, there's something this guy is brilliant about. He's a PhD, blah, blah, blah. And so I discovered that he cares about certain phase quasars, blah, 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 and ended up learning about those things for hours. And I don't care about those things, but for those couple hours, I was fascinated by it. And so I think it's like an intentional curiosity that we can try to develop in ourselves that like helps us. I don't know. That's my hope for my kid, is that they become curious, you know?
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great.
Okay, so studied music, went off to school. I assume that you were majoring in guitar performance. Was that what they called it?
Music theory.
So you weren't even in performance. So the theory, did that, was that part of the load?
Well, I'm actually trying to remember. It was like performance, one was a major, one was a minor.
Oh, okay, got it. So a little bit of both.
I can't even remember. But yeah, I was doing both.
You lost the passion in the middle of college. Did you graduate with that degree or did you switch to a different degree program?
I didn't even finish college.
Oh, yeah.
I dropped out. Yeah. So in the middle of all of this, I started losing interest and then I started focusing on code a little bit.
Okay.
And it was funny. I remember talking to my mom about it and she was very upset about this because, of course, she was a musician and a writer. So she thought her kid was going to follow in her footsteps. And then suddenly I'm like leaning towards programming. And I was trying to explain to her, like, no, there's a huge amount of creativity in this.
Yeah.
But to her, it's just like, code,
right.
Very soulless. Mechanical,
right.
Soulless, not an ounce of creativity in it, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
But anyways, I started focusing on that more and more. And it's like the more I got into programming, the less I was into music. And it's just slowly faded off.
So one of the questions I always ask everybody, sorry to cut you off, is when did you first get access to a computer and when did you first start getting into programming?
Okay. I'm going to have to apologize because I was listening to some of your other episodes and everyone like got into programming when they were 10 years old or something. Uh-huh. Not for me at all. So my first computer wasn't even my computer, of course. It was the family computer. I remember playing Number Munchers, which was this old game on the Mac. Yeah, I think we've talked about that before. I was obsessed with Number Munchers. I'll listen to DHH interviews, and he'll talk about when he was 7 years old learning this old language that I've never heard of. That wasn't me, honestly. I didn't even show much interest at all until I was about 17, honestly. Yeah. And even then, it was like I'd learn a little HTML, just enough to write a blog post or something
right.
like that. But I didn't have any huge fascination with code. I didn't know what it was, yeah. honestly. You know, I was focused on music. But I would say, like, so much of what I learned from music, I feel like has crossed over, weirdly mm-hmm. enough. The whole idea of, like, looking for patterns and shapes and just the discipline to stick with something that you can't do, and then suddenly you can't do it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that helped me when learning programming. Because so many things with programming, it's like you just have to sit there for 4 hours until it clicks in your head.
Yeah.
You know? I have lots of memories of, in the early days, I don't do it anymore, but when I was young, I'd stay up till 3 a.m. just trying to figure something out because it wouldn't click.
Yeah.
And then I love that feeling of all of a sudden you think, oh, I
glorious
get it.
Revelation.
I understand how this works now. And it's yeah. like there's no shortcut. You just have to sit there for hours until it clicks. It's a great feeling.
I had that moment both with object-oriented programming and unit testing. And obviously, I've had much smaller ones, but those were both ones where it took months. And everyone would talk about the thing, and it'd talk about the thing, and I just didn't get it. And then all of a sudden, it was like, what have I been doing my whole life up until now?
Right.
Okay,
right.
So a lot of people who have your story, and by the way, I want to totally affirm the fact that, like, I think that if everybody said, hey, I started computers when I was 7, then it would be discouraging to folks who are just getting into it now. Like, there is plenty of space, and even Muhammad's, you know, story a little bit, like, had a little bit of, like, the later as well. I mean, there's space for anybody to come in at any age and any time. I think that the most significant thing is people in our generation, you know, people in the probably, I don't know exactly, but they're late 20s to late 30s, probably somewhere around there. We're like kind of old millennials, early or young Gen Xers or whatever. I feel like a lot of us have a similar story just because in order to be a full-time programmer right now, it's likely that you got into it earlier. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had enough kind of history to be a full-time programmer now. But that's not guaranteed. I mean, you're a full-time programmer and have been for years. So it's cool to hear a story that's a little bit different than what we've had. So mm-hmm. a lot of people, when they talk about, especially since you didn't get to it because you had somebody in the family who's a programmer, you weren't taking classes, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, I played video games and I was, you know, my clan, I made the clan website or something. What was it for you?
Oh, it was a, so my parents were starting this because my mom was a writer. They had this idea for a business. I talked about this at the last Laricon. They had this idea for a business where aspiring songwriters could send in, mail in their tapes.
Right.
And then you'd get actual professionals to review it. And they would actually record themselves. They'd go over the song. They'd give you advice. This was a long time ago. And then they'd send it back. And they'd been talking about this idea for a long time. And I remember it was Christmas night. We went out for Chinese food when I was, I don't know how old I was, 19 maybe. And we were talking about it. And I said, you know, I could probably build this website.
Right.
Once again, not even close. Like, I was so arrogant, so ridiculously arrogant. No, I couldn't build a site. But in my head, I was like, you know what? I could get a book and I'll just figure it out. And
did you know
I'll build
any
this for you guys.
Back-end programming language at all at that point?
No, I knew HTML. And when I created HTML tags, of course, they were in all uppercase.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's it. That's like all I knew. And I was just thinking, oh, I'll go get some programming book. And of course, like when you think, okay, I'm going to learn how to build a website, I need a programming book, you're immediately presented with choices that you're not capable of,
yeah.
of solving. Like, okay, do you get a PHP book? Or are you going to learn Visual Basic or C#? Do I try ASP.NET?
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't know what any of these things are. I don't know how to distinguish between a language or a framework. So I have no clue which book to get in. Yeah, I had no clue which book. I had no idea where to start, even remotely. But it was a good adventure, you know, in hindsight.
Do you remember what book you got?
I'm kind of mad at this. My brother recommended I get an ASP.NET book.
Oh, and yeah.
And you know what? Like, in hindsight, I feel like that was bad advice, not to throw him under the bus.
Yeah.
But I didn't know I knew HTML, but no, I didn't.
Yeah.
I knew how to make a bold tag and an italic tag. But I feel like the advice should have been, okay, go find some kind of HTML and yeah. CSS for Dummies type book. Learn that. Figure out how to create boxes and move things around. That's really step one before you even get to programming.
Yeah.
But no, I kind of started with ASP.NET, and I was learning Visual Basic. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm trying to build this site for them. But going through the book, it's having me build more, like, little programs, like make a little calculator.
Yeah.
This little, and it's like making a calculator in Visual Basic really has no relevance to how you would construct a website.
Yeah.
But that's what I was learning how to do. And it was cool that I was figuring out, like, oh, I'm making a little crappy calculator here. But it didn't get me any closer whatsoever to building this website.
Right.
So then at some point, what did I... I worked in .NET for a little while, but then... it's been so long. At some point, I switched over to PHP because it seemed... Well, I switched over to PHP and I was kind of learning Ruby too. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people do that where it's like, you're not really sure. You kind of experiment with a handful of different languages. But yeah, eventually I zeroed in on PHP. But you know what? Actually, looking back, for that website, it was built in ASP.NET, actually.
Huh. I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
It was horrible. It was a horrible site.
Yeah. No, I've written some ASP.NET in my days, and it was not exactly the same, but I was a PHP developer who got an internship at an ASP.NET site, our company. And I was able to do most of what I needed to do as like building little reporting front ends for them in PHP, but every once in a while I had to write ASP.NET. And walking into ASP.NET and Visual Basic not knowing what you're doing, I feel like is not the same as walking into PHP not knowing what you're doing.
No.
So it was, yeah, that's, I can imagine.
It was horrible. It's so complicated. Oh my gosh. It's still to this day, I feel like my brother told me that just because he worked in the industry too.
Yeah.
And then like maybe he was like, this is too hard for you, Jeffrey. So take a look at this book and you'll be scared away.
Is he still a programmer?
Yeah, he is.
Okay, so you've got both music and programming in the family then.
Yeah.
All right. And my brother's a .NET programmer as well, still is this.
Oh, he is, okay.
Yeah, but he's the one who originally taught me Vim and PHP, so I can at least credit him for getting me in the right angle. So.
Yeah. So why didn't you stick with .NET? How'd you switch to PHP?
No, he taught me Vim and PHP. He switched over to .NET later,
gotcha.
And I was doing WordPress at the time, so there's no reason for me to switch, so...
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so you and Taylor both have .NET in your background. I mean,
isn't that funny?
Yeah, I did .NET at that job and hated it. I was like, you guys are doing these crazy compile processes, whereas I can build this web-based front end in PHP to give them all the information they need. It's going to take me 3 days. It's going to take you guys 3 weeks and 15 compiles in this crazy environment, and I can write it in a text editor and get it online in 3 days.
I know. That was the joy of PHP for me, and I was always amazed because... Not so much now. It still happens now, but especially way back then, 10 or 15 years ago, PHP just got crapped all over.
It sure did.
People would make fun of it. And when I came to that from working with ASP and ASP.NET, it was really nice.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, I can just create an HTML file. I'll add a little PHP above the doc type, and then it actually kind of works.
Dynamic data.
And it's like,
right,
holy
there.
Crap, this is really nice.
Yeah.
I know people trash that way of programming, but to me, it was like, wow, this is so much simpler than what I've been doing over here.
Yeah. Especially if you'd written any ASP, like I went from classic ASP to PHP. So like at that point, PHP is glorious because classic ASP was like PHP, but not as good basically. So that was that transition just makes you love PHP. So I can understand you crap on it if it's coming from somewhere else, but there's some places where you come to PHP and it's like the motherland.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you got into .NET a little bit. You so you didn't finish the guitar stuff, so you were out on your own. Were you doing freelance web development, or what were you doing, you know, kind of to pass the time or to pay the bills or whatever for those first couple of years?
Yeah, I did a number of things. So I started doing freelance web development. Once again, just so in over my head. The arrogance of thinking I could take on these projects for people when I had 6 months of experience. But I started... I created a website called Detached Designs. I had this idea in my head that I was a designer, which couldn't be further from the truth. But that's what it started out as. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do custom web design for people. And I created Craigslist ads. And
nice.
For some reason, they always got reported as spam. I'm like, they're not spam, folks. I'm trying to make some money. But anyways, somebody eventually hired me. And one of the first projects I ever did, I think I talked about this somewhere else. I can't remember. But it was an earn site.
Earn
as in like when you die and you're cremated, they put you
like
in, yeah.
Ceremonial urns.
A decorative urn.
Yeah, yeah. Decorative. Wait, is this the one where you were storing the credit card information?
No. That was another one.
That was later.
No, this was just a simple site. Some woman out of her house was selling decorative urns.
Mm-hmm.
So morbid. And she wanted me to create a website to show them and people could pick the one they wanted. But
was it
again,
dynamic
was
where she could like upload them to CMS, or was it just kind
no.
of... Yeah, okay, that's
no.
what I thought. Just a whole bunch of pictures.
No.
Yeah.
I was just proud enough to get the images on the page, honestly.
Yeah.
So I had like a nice, probably using a table layout or something.
Of
Actually,
course.
No, I was learning CSS. I don't know. I might have been fancy there. Probably not. Anyways, yeah, just a crappy little thing. I don't even know if I had pagination. Probably rather than pagination, I just created... if there were 4 pages worth of urns, I would just create four HTML pages to show them. But you know what? Like, that stuff is good for you. Like, everyone kind of has to go through that process of just building junk. I made a little money off of it, and I think she eventually abandoned it, but that's okay.
I was just going to ask if it's still online.
No, so, I was hoping it. I probably could use a Wayback Machine to find it, but I can't even remember what the domain name was anymore.
So that was your first paid project? Yeah,
I think I made $350 off that.
Nice.
And I was like, I'm doing it. I'm making some money here. This is the future. I'm all in.
That's amazing. My first one's still online, and I made $200 from it. And it's the same. They sell flowers, and they sell daylilies. So it's the same thing. Just daylily after daylily after daylily after daylily. Basic stuff. Table layout.
It's still on. Well, mine's not still online, so you must have done a much better job.
Got to see if you can find it in the Wayback Machine, though. We'll get that in the show notes if you can find it.
And then I did a handful of things along like those couple, maybe a year or two. I did one for like a Harvard sorority, believe it or not. I don't know why they contacted me on Nashville Craigslist.
Right.
They were called the Harvard. I can't even remember their name. They were almost like an a cappella group, like Pitch Perfect. It was something like that. And I made their site. They wanted all this hot pink and black. It cracked me up. The whole site was hot pink and black.
Right.
That's fun. I'm trying to remember some of the other things I did. It's been so long. It's amazing how quickly that stuff just kind of exits your brain.
Yeah.
But yeah, lots of little small stuff like that.
So during that time, you decided you weren't going to do music anymore. You were still living in that area, and you were just doing freelance web development, and that was kind of your main thing. Were you working together with any other people? Were you married at this point yet? And kind of what else were you doing in your life at that point?
Yeah, at this point I was probably 21, and I was still trying to piece things together. So I didn't feel qualified to try to get a job anywhere as a developer. Because even at that time I was thinking maybe I should go back to school and actually learn this for real. So at this point, nope, I wasn't married. I didn't get married until 25, 26.
Oh, okay.
My wife's going to kill me. I can't remember. I remember 2011 is when I got married.
Yes, as long as you remember the day and the year, you're good.
Yeah. It's hard to remember the age. But so I stuck with that for a while. And then I got a pretty big contract, at least I call it contract, like it's really fancy. I just got a pretty cool job working for a company called Sirona. And they create like all these medical, I don't even know what it was. It was just all these medical scan machines that they use, those things that cost like $500,000 a pop.
Yeah.
And somehow, once again, they came to me. It's just idiotic why they would take something that big and give it to like a stupid kid who didn't know what he was doing. But somehow I was like creating their website, and I was even creating those little brochures and mailer. That's where I learned about mailers that they would send out to people. So suddenly I was doing like design work, and I was buying all these design books I could find. And then I was suddenly like making a Flash website for them, which was the worst experience I've ever had.
That was my next question. Did you ever get into Flash?
I got into Flash a little bit, and I hated it. And I was so worried because back then I was thinking, you know what? This is the future. Like, just to show you, like, whenever people say, where's the web going? I would have told you back then, I think Flash is probably the future.
Everybody else would too. Everyone said it all the time. Flash is the future. Got to get into Flash.
Yeah. It's like anyone who made just kind of traditional websites, it's like, you can't even begin to compete. Because, of course, every single client you might work with, they wanted music in the background. And they wanted, like, when you hovered over a link, they wanted a little sound effect.
Yeah.
You know, all that old school stuff from 2005. But, yeah, I was thinking, like, I got to learn this. This is going to be the future. But I hated it. I really don't enjoy that aspect of it whatsoever. And then, as it turns out, Flash is almost completely dead at this point.
Yeah.
I didn't know that back then.
It makes you a little wary of the promises that JavaScript SPAs are going to take over the whole world. Kind of a lot of the sounds the same as Flash did back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It could be true as well. I'm not sure about SPAs. SPAs are like, on one hand, they're so cool and they're so responsive. And then on the other hand, it's like so often they break and they don't work.
Yeah.
Or they suck up memory and I don't know.
Never let it
Sometimes
go.
I go to those news sites where there's SPAs and everything's fancy and you click on a news article and it slides in and it's like, okay, this is cool, but I'm not sure if this is better.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's a tangent. But yeah, I spent a long time working for Sirona, and I that's where I kind of built up a lot of my jack of all trades chops, because I was doing a lot of design work.
Right.
Somehow I was piecing it together. And then I was doing web work and flash work. So I feel like that gave me this huge crash course in just general design and development that I'm pretty grateful for.
So during this time, you weren't playing music anymore. What were your hobbies then?
Code. Like I'm pretty obsessive. That was my thing. Like I once, like I was saying earlier with guitar, it's like for a lot of people, but for me, it's like if you find the thing, you get hooked. So I got the bug and I was really focused on that. Because also at the time, I dropped out of college because I was no longer focusing on music. And I don't know, college wasn't a great fit for me personally. So I was still thinking like, well, I need to focus on something because you can't just drop out of college and deliver pizza all day. Yeah. So I did have the mindset like, no, I need to be focusing on something. So that was my day job, was just during the day. Or during the evening, I would be reading books every single day. Huh. And then during the day, I'd be working on these little projects I got. And then slowly, like the caliber of project grew and grew, took on some more fancy stuff, got a little more dynamic. So, yeah, interesting.
So that is super interesting. I did not realize that this was all part of your story, which is why I was excited to interview. So you dropped out, I think you said you were sometime around 2021. And you're doing this freelance stuff. What's the next big transition point? I assume it wasn't straight to there from NetTuts, but was it? I mean, where'd you go from there?
A lot of, probably for 4 years, maybe, lots of projects that are just me or me and one or two other people that we tackled together. But I did that for a long time. Lots of freelance stuff. I started like a little business to do that with one or two other people. And then I took on NetTuts as like side work. Because when I take on these projects, the scary thing is, you know, I wasn't at your level, even remotely. So it's like, I'd get a project, but there's no guarantee that another project's coming in once finished.
I remember those days.
Right. So it was always this kind of terrifying thing. And then I started writing freelance articles. There was what was the site called? I think it's called freelancer.com. It's under new ownership at this point. But back then, there were these websites dedicated to freelancers. Because it was the first time, I think, way back then when it suddenly became a real possibility that you could work on the computer at home.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you had all these freelancers talking about how to do things, and I was starting to write posts for them, kind of for fun. I actually went back and read some of them, and they're so horrible. One of them was like how, like, if you're a young freelancer, you have to get an edge over the competition. And the way I would do it was to make myself available 24 hours a day. It's so embarrassing at this point, but I was like, yeah, if they need me at 2 a.m, I'm going to be available. Like some company's ever going to call me at 2 a.m, but that was my idea of like how to stand out, because all the other businesses are 9 to 5, but I'm going to be 2 a.m. to 2 p.m. And it was so horrible. It was really embarrassing going back to read that. That's the hard thing about like your ideas when you're 19 or 20 or 21.
Yeah.
On the web, they're going to be there in 20 more years, and people can go back and find all the stupid crap you wrote or the forum threads you created where you're asking the most silly, simple questions. It all stays. It never goes away. It scares me sometimes. But I did that for a long time. So after Freelancer, the owner of that website put me in contact with Collis, who is the founder of Envato. And I talked to him about NetTuts. And once again, I was like, okay, I can make an extra $1,000 a month just kind of learning, because I was already learning every single day and then just showing people what I'd learned. And so I did that kind of on the side. I did both of them simultaneously for, I'm not sure, I can't remember, a year. And then they asked me to run NetTuts, and I took over that. And then suddenly I was doing this whole other thing where I was focusing on education and building up a platform, which I'd never done before, which is interesting. It was fun.
Were you still doing any freelance work, or did you transition to just a full-time NetTuts at that point?
Well, while I was writing for NetTuts, I was still doing both. But then when I transferred over to... Actually, no, I managed NetTuts for a while, maybe a year or two while I was still doing both. And then I started taking on more roles at Envato.
Yeah.
I was helping out with some of the marketplaces that Envato has, like Graphic River or Theme Forest or Code Canyon. And I was really starting to focus more in that area, so I stopped doing freelance stuff, which I was very happy about.
Yeah.
It's a hard life doing... freelance stuff on Craigslist is hard work.
I don't want to talk too much about me, but I did the freelance in that same world, and I actually, that was part of the reason that I left web for half a decade. I don't even know how ever long, for a long time.
Oh, yeah?
Because I hated freelance. I hated that pressure to always come up with the next work. I just wanted to do good work, right? And like, it's, you're doing good work and convincing more people that you can do good work and finding the people to convince and worrying about your finances all the time, right? And so mm-hmm. like the promise of just stability is something that I don't think that a lot of people kind of speak up about enough. You're just like, yeah, there's going to be a paycheck. And you get to just worry about doing the thing you want mm-hmm. and let somebody else worry about getting the work coming in.
Yeah, so. It's so much more stress. If you have a traditional job, you go there 9 to 5, you get your paycheck, you're good. Once you leave work, you don't think about it again.
Yep.
But when you're freelancing, it's like, yes, you're doing that work. But when you're not working, you're stressing about how you're going to get more work and how yep. you're going to pay next month's rent. Because every month on the 1st, your income goes back to 0. Yep. And now you have to figure out, okay, how do I pay the rent this month?
Yeah.
And then the next month goes back to 0. Everything resets. Yeah, it'll wear you down for sure.
Yeah. So you transition, you're full-time at NetTuts and Envato. So outside of the things with like the other properties, just your work at NetTuts, what was your day-to-day like at that point? Like what kind of stuff were you responsible for?
Yeah. At NetTuts, my main role was build up this product.
Got it.
And at its prime, NetTuts actually got very big. It makes me sad because they've changed it a lot, and I don't think it's as popular anymore. I don't visit as much anymore because they kind of merged. The whole idea with, to give you a quick recap, they launched this tutorial site called PSD Tuts, which was like Photoshop tutorials,
right.
And it was huge.
Yeah.
And then they started branching, and they're like, well, maybe we should do the same concept for web development. So yeah. They had NetTuts. And then they're like, let's do another one. Let's branch out. And they kept branching out over and over. But all this time, I was really focused on NetTuts. That's all I cared about. And then they decided, probably correctly, like we need to merge everything into this one cohesive whole
yeah.
where people can learn anything. And it makes sense. But then also from my perspective, it's like, well, I don't care about Photoshop tutorials or craft
right.
tutorials. But now you've merged everything together and I no longer feel like this site is for me.
Yeah.
But I feel like they had to do it, you know, looking back. They had no choice. They had to do it because they were maintaining a dozen different tutorial sites, and each one of those were their own WordPress installations.
Yeah.
So when you would make a change, like I'm pretty sure they were having to make that change 10 different times across each installation.
Yeah.
It's horrible. So it made sense that they merged it.
If there was a technical consideration, it does make you wonder whether some aspect of like multi-site might have ended up being something so you can make the right business decision without allowing the technology to make the call for you. But who knows what all it was involved in that decision. So.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, so a lot of my day-to-day was suddenly I was an editor. You know, I'd never done any of this. So often in my life, I've gotten thrown into things that I wasn't the least bit qualified for. That might be my fault, just saying like, oh, yeah, I can do that, of course. When I had no clue what it meant to be an editor. But suddenly I was doing a lot of writing on my own, but also finding writers and working with developers mm-hmm. and figuring out how that plays and editing their work. Suddenly I was like editing the writing of people 20 years older than me, which was crazy.
Yeah.
And one of the coolest things about this though, I found was that like back then I had this idea of like my heroes, web developer people I really looked up to.
Yeah.
But I'd never contacted them before. And then suddenly I realized they're just people exactly like you and me.
Yeah.
Like in no way, shape or form are they like actors, celebrity types. They're just regular people. And if you message them or email them or tweet them, they're really friendly and they'll reply back. And that was a very cool thing for me because it was like, oh, I've read all of your books.
Right.
I know you. Like you taught me how to write CSS.
Yeah.
And then I contact them and they're pretty cool. And then suddenly they were writing for NetTuts. I would get them to contribute articles and stuff.
That's awesome. So,
yeah, it was a fun experience. I did that for about 5 years. And then throughout that whole thing, I ended up taking on a bunch of roles at Envato. So I was doing a lot of things, but I just kind of burned out.
Yeah.
I think it's good as much as you can to sometimes switch to new things, to always have new projects you're working on. And I think sometimes if you stick with exactly one project, it starts to wear you down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like talking to kind of independent creators and founders to try and figure out like what are you able to do to ensure that this one thing that you're working on doesn't just kind of burn you out? Because so one of my buddies, Matt Green, he went from working at a consultancy, we worked at the same consultancy, to now he's the sole tech and web guy at this very large, you know, multinational corporation. And so on the one hand, he gets to do really creative things. He's on a single project and he gets, every time a new tech comes out, he's like, cool, I'll throw it in here if it's useful. So he gets to use tech that I might never get to use because I never hit a project that has it. But in the same token, he's on that same project every day for years. And so I'm always curious, like, what does it look like for somebody who's in that kind of a space to make sure that you don't get bored of working on it? So I know for you, one of the things that you do is redesigns. And obviously also you've got the content, right? When you cover a new piece of content, maybe you're not applying that content to the Laracast's code base, but you're writing little sample projects and stuff. But what in your day-to-day with Laracast does it look like to help yourself kind of get that shift? Or are you not able to get it? And at one point you're going to shut Laracast down and we'll all kind of fall into despair.
Probably fall into despair. I try to have a lot of variety because I think, once again, like Laracast is my main product. So I do think about that. What if you burn out on it? But I think what's helped me a lot is having lots of different things. So it's not just like I focus on the Laracast code base and I don't just focus on content for Laracast, which often is like creating demos and stuff. Mm-hmm. But also like I have open source projects that I maintain. So I have like lots of different little projects where it keeps me interested, I think, where I can say like, okay, today I'm exclusively focusing on Laravel Mix.
Yeah.
And that is completely different than the type of code I write for Laracast. And then if I'm done with that, then I will completely focus on some demo or something, which is really fun. Like most developers don't get the opportunity to just tinker because you have a job, you know, you have to get the job done. You don't always have the ability to try out some new language or tool. But Laracast kind of affords me that, where I can dedicate a day or two a week, or at least a half day, a couple times a week, and just tinker around, try out new stuff, see how it works. So I'm really fortunate for that.
I mean, you could build a whole clone of Facebook and basically call it, you know, a part of the development process.
Like, absolutely.
Or a whole forum software or whatever. And then and it's legitimate too. Like you could build the whole thing and not even make any videos about it. And it would have expanded your brain or give you some perspective that nobody else would have had.
Yeah, so absolutely.
That's cool.
And so often the content I do for Laracast is usually the result of actual coding work I'm doing.
Yeah.
So like the, about a month ago, I implemented this really sweet new Algolia search into Laracast where it's like live on the fly. It's really great. But I was like, okay, I have this figured out. Most people don't have it figured out yet. So those are a perfect two or three videos that I can do for the site.
Right.
And I feel like those are the best types of content I can do because, I don't know, it's really hard as a teacher. I know you don't want to get focused on this too much,
no,
but
it's good.
Real quick.
It's good.
As a teacher, if you're too separated from the person learning, they can't like the things you take for granted and the things you don't even realize you take for granted, they don't take for granted. So you'll use terminology that's just part of your everyday speak, and they don't know what it means.
Yeah.
So it's like you sometimes need to be like, it's that same thing where in school, sometimes the kid sitting next to you can teach a concept way better than the teacher can.
Yep.
It's that same thing because like they're on your same wavelength, and they know where you're struggling. So I always worry like if the more I figure things out and the better I become, the further separated I am from somebody who's just learning PHP for the first time.
Yeah.
And I have to deal with it. I get this a lot where somebody's like, slow down, you're going too fast. Or other people will say, you're going too slow, speed up.
Right.
Or somebody will say, you keep using fancy jargon. And I hate that idea of using fancy jargon. And usually it's the term for this. I'm not trying to show off here. It's just the term for it. But I forget, oh, you don't know what that term is. Yeah, so these are the things I always end up thinking about when I create content for Laracast. So it's very hard. It's very hard to walk that line.
I've asked Taylor a lot about what are the steps that he takes to make sure that, like, as he's updating the documentation, he can put himself in the mindset of a new learner. It sounds like one of the things you're saying is when you learn something, that's the best time to teach it, right? When you're trying a new thing because you're closest to the wire of the learner. Are there any other things other than putting yourself in a learner's posture, you know, by learning new things, or any other things you find that you do that helps you kind of remember that perspective?
That perspective of what makes it easier to learn?
Well, yeah, that and just, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. You know, are there relationships you have or comments, threads that you look at or postures you take or mental exercises or something that helps you keep yourself grounded to the experience of the person who opened up Laracast for the first time yesterday versus who's been with you for the last X years?
Yeah. Nothing that I could describe.
Yeah.
I don't think. It's usually just trying to remind myself to assume. Don't assume too much.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love that phrase explained to me like I'm a 5-year-old. There's actually a Reddit group for that I always read. And the whole concept is explain this thing to me like I'm a 5-year-old and it'll be anything. It'll be politics or anything related. And I love it because everyone who replies is very friendly and they just explain it perfectly. They don't use anything too fancy. They're not trying to show off. They're not trying to make you look stupid. They're just trying to explain this concept to you. So that's what I try to do as best as I can, but I'm pretty sure many times I completely fail. Sometimes people will cancel their accounts and just say it was way too hard.
Yeah.
It makes me sad. But you know, that's how it is. Like with Laracast, like I'm training people who have 6 months of experience total, and then also working professional developers watch the site too. And the understanding they have about code couldn't be further apart. So how do you do a video that appeals to both of them? It's very, very difficult.
Yeah. I mean, you do it masterfully, but it's cool to hear that it's just an ongoing process of trying to be mindful and trying to figure it out and recognizing you're not perfect at it, but, you know, you kind of have what you have to give, and that's all there is.
Yeah. I try to take the approach of, this is what I've figured out. Could be right. You know, I'm not trying to say this is the right way. I really hate that idea, but this is what I've figured out at this moment. If I change my mind, I'll let you know. But
yeah, that's cool. So, yeah. Okay, so we had talked about you were spending your time in NetTuts, and you were while it was NetTuts. So while it was NetTuts, I followed it religiously, so I should remember this. But I know it was covering front end web development and a little bit of design and stuff like that. How much did NetTuts get into the back end?
A decent amount. We once again, for a site like that, you can't just do everything.
Right.
Because the more you stretch and it's like, we're going to cover every element of web development, it's that exact thing again where it's like, well, now nobody really cares because there's a 1 in 20 chance that an article is going to be relevant to them.
Right.
So we predominantly focused on PHP and then HTML, CSS, JavaScript.
Yeah.
But then sometimes we would branch out to Node and Python. But those were always like every once in a while. But you got to keep the core of a specific type of developer. So I definitely learned that from NetTuts. But yeah, so, we did. Go ahead.
When did you get started doing videos?
At NetTuts. No, actually before then. When I launched that little business called Detached Designs, where I was doing my own stuff, even then I would record. I was learning ASP.NET, and there was this guy named Joe Stagner. And on the ASP.NET website, he would record videos for learning ASP.NET. And it was so beneficial to me. For whatever reason, you either have like a visual... You're either a visual learner or you're not.
Yeah.
And I realized when I would watch him, I would learn so much more than reading these books. So I started doing the same thing. So you could probably track down really old videos of mine where I was teaching ASP.NET. Please don't, because they're horrid. They're unbelievably horrible.
I got to find one to put it in the show notes.
They're really, please don't, because it's really, really bad. It was probably recorded at like 600 by 400 and really blurry. Yeah. People forget, we take the idea of a clear code screencast for granted.
Yeah.
It was not easy to do that.
Yeah.
YouTube can do that, all of them. But way back then, you would upload like a screencast to YouTube and they would compress it so much that you couldn't read it, even at the top quality. It was a serious issue that a lot of people had. Unless you could afford to stream at the high quality, but then most people didn't have fast enough bandwidths to watch it. So it was an actual thing people had to worry about back then. I was recording these Detached Designs video tutorials on ASP.NET. It feels like another world, but that's when I got started. When was that? Maybe 2003, 2004,
okay,
right around there.
I was going to say, it didn't seem like you had started at NetTuts, because by the time you were doing them there, you seemed really accomplished as a presenter, but I didn't know whether that's because you'd been doing it prior or whether it just comes, you know, that naturally to you.
I don't know. Maybe a little of both. Yeah. I think sometimes people give me a little too much credit. I'll see this on Twitter a lot where somebody will say, I have a lot more respect for Jeffrey now because I just tried to record a video tutorial and my gosh, is it hard. And I think they're thinking I hit record and then I just fluently go through the whole thing.
Right.
And then 30 minutes later, I hit stop. And that's not the way it works. I probably make 50 mistakes over that course. And then I just chop them up during the edit. So, but I think other people think, if I screw up, I have to start all over and record again. And it's like, no, it's very, very difficult to do that fluently with code. Very, very difficult. And almost that's, impossible.
It's so valuable to hear that, because I've done some videos before, and when I felt like I had to do it the whole way, especially you're talking 5, 10, 15 minutes, there's just no way. I mean, you could script it, you can practice it 15 times, and you're still going to make mistakes. And when I first bring somebody on the podcast who's never podcasted before, one of the first disclaimers I have to make is, just because you hit the record button doesn't mean you now have to be like you're in front of a TV camera live. Like, this isn't live, which means you can just flub it and you can say, oh, you know what? I want to say that again, and I'll just edit it out later. Like, that's all possible.
Right,
we just
right.
don't it's think about seconds. That by default.
I know. You think you're like on camera doing the weather or something and you have to get it perfect.
Right.
Nope. I make so many mistakes. If you would see my ScreenFlow program after I'm done editing, there's 100 different cuts. Sometimes I'll say, too much, which I hate. I'm probably doing it here like crazy. I hate that. I always try to edit that out. Little things, if I pause too long. Like sometimes you're coding something and I'll be recording and it won't work. And it's like,
right.
Oh, that's supposed to work. And it's failing. And then you'll see 2 minutes of silence on the video once I'm done. And I just edit that out. And then suddenly you think, oh, Jeffrey figured that out in 4 seconds.
Yeah.
But no, it took a few minutes to figure out what the problem was.
I remember when I first started Twitch streaming, I was just, you know, I said, you know, this is an antidote to anybody having any elevated concept of me, because you watch how much of my time is spent reading documentation and Stack Overflowing and beating my head against a simple typo that everybody who watches the video will notice, but it wasn't in my brain at that moment. And I go back and I'm like, oh, why am I doing this to myself? Why am I exposing how stupid I am to the whole world?
Yours were good too. There's definitely a charm to that though as well, because
yeah.
I wish you would do them more. I know Adam does some. I don't think he's done any recently as well.
Yeah.
But there's a charm to that approach too, because everyone knows that that's part of it. And there's fun watching a person figure something out.
Like, yeah.
Okay, we're going to go to Reddit. We're going to read the documentation. How do I do this? Like, there's a charm to that as well. It's just for Laracast, I'm trying to keep it a little more condensed.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think you need both, actually.
Because
once again, people may watch a video and think I'm way more talented than I am. It's like, no, I'm piecing things together. You just don't see the part where I went to Reddit.
Right.
Because something didn't work.
That's cool. Okay,
Reddit, Stack Overflow.
Yeah, Stack Overflow. Okay, so NetTuts, eventually they gathered everything together in one space. And at that point, you started feeling like it wasn't something you could buy in on as much. That probably planted a seed in your brain to start moving on to something else. And around this point, I assume that you had made some connection to Laravel. But I remember that for me and a lot of other people, that the Jeffrey Way, who we've learned to trust over years, giving his really strong backing to Laravel pretty early, was a big part of us being willing to kind of make that jump. Can you tell me a little bit about what your early exposure to Laravel looked like?
Yeah, so I left PHP quite a bit at that point. Other than one or two lingering projects I had, I was mostly doing Ruby work. I was doing a lot of Ruby, some Sinatra stuff, some Rails stuff, and it was great. I really enjoyed it. And then I came across Laravel. This would have been right at the end of Laravel 2, maybe? I don't know. The time span between Laravel 1 and Laravel 3 was actually really short.
Yeah.
It's not like Laravel 4 to Laravel 5.
We're talking months.
Yeah, months. So I think I more or less got in right when he was working on it. And I guess he was promoting Laravel 3 at that time. So I was like, okay, I'll check this out. And immediately I noticed that the branding was really good. And the design was great. And you just didn't see this much back then.
Yeah.
People think about it a little more now. But back then, it wasn't very good. And suddenly I was like, oh, this branding is right on point. The layout is good. I'm reading through the documentation. It's really well thought out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give this a go. So I started tinkering around with it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. This works really, really well. It has a lot of what I like from Sinatra. It has a lot of what I like from Rails. I would love to know how much Taylor experimented with these other frameworks when building Laravel. Because my instinct is he didn't do it that much, but then he must have, because Laravel has some of the best components of each of these. It has Active Record, of course, from Rails. Some of the routing syntax from Sinatra was very similar in Laravel. So I kept tinkering with it more, and I started becoming more and more outspoken. And I was participating on there used to be a Laravel forum, a dedicated Laravel.com forum. It doesn't exist anymore, but I was asking a question there, and Taylor immediately responded, and he was really nice. It was the first time I ever talked to him, and he said something like, "If you need any help whatsoever, just let me know. Glad to help." And I was like, "Oh, this is really friendly guy."
Right.
Created a great product. I'm immediately talking to the owner of it. I'm gonna give this a go, and it just kept getting better and better. So the more outspoken I was, because I was still working at NetTuts at that time, I was able to kind of give Laravel a really big push. And suddenly I was doing Laravel tutorials and videos.
Yeah.
And I like to think I really helped Laravel get a push in the early
yes.
days. So, yeah, it was great.
Okay. So NetTuts, Laravel, what was the process like of deciding to leave NetTuts? And what was the process like of deciding to found Laracasts? And how connected were the two?
Okay. Very connected. Too connected, probably, in hindsight. I was getting to the point with Envato where I was feeling that burnout a little bit. I was starting to notice things where it's like I didn't like, and I bet a lot of people have this with their companies, where you start to feel like your opinion isn't actually factoring into decisions.
Yep.
I think as a manager, you have to be very careful of this, where if you make a person feel like their opinion isn't really relevant, or you make them feel like, okay, thanks for your opinion, in one ear, out the other. And I was starting to feel that more and more. Or maybe it was just in my head, but I wanted to have more control over the direction of things. And I was starting to get the hint, like, it's not going to happen. And so I started thinking, well, what if I made my own NetTuts? But it would be focused on Laravel, because I'm really into Laravel right now. It's great. I'd love to give that a push. I can do that on the side. In my warped head, I was thinking that would be okay, but it's a huge conflict of interest in hindsight.
Right.
But on the side, I was building up Laracasts while still running NetTuts and doing all the stuff at Envato. And then at one point, I launched Laracasts, and I kind of had to put in my notice at Envato because we decided it was very much a conflict of interest. But yeah, so they were very, very connected. But the big idea for me wasn't just to build Laracasts. It was just to have something where I had more control. And where I felt like my opinion actually mattered, and where I could say, this is what I want to do. And then suddenly the next week, you're actually working on that.
Yep.
At Envato, like Envato grew so quickly. And by the way, I don't want to shame Envato in the least, because I think Envato is a fantastic company. And what they've done is unbelievable, and they're incredibly generous. Every year, they donate so much money to all of these different causes. So I'm saying this more just... In working at any business, you sometimes get to a point where you feel like, I need a change. I need a little more say in things. I want to feel like my opinion actually matters. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the impetus for starting the Laracasts.
Okay. So I can't believe that we're already at time, but I can't cut it just yet. So I've got to figure out what of my many remaining questions I'm going to ask. So just for a fun one, a while back you talked about working 4-hour days and switching up kind of what your relationship to work looked like. And, you know, you and I joked together a little about how viable that was. But what I love is the idea that the 9-to-5, the working for somebody else, you know, all those things might not be the only way to succeed. But I also always have a lot of caveats from my experience working as a freelancer about just how miserable being a freelancer can be at sometimes. And I think people think, I don't want to work for myself. I want to start my own company. And I always tell them, if you start your own company and you have employees, you're going to spend more time managing than doing the thing you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other piece is, I don't want to work for somebody else. I'll go freelance. And then I talk about all the things we've talked about here. So you kind of have a little bit of all of these experiences. Now, you don't have... full-time employees at Laracasts, so maybe you haven't gotten to that misery part, but it seems like you've got the sweet spot where you're not worrying as much about getting the next client. Now, obviously, if everybody unsubscribed, that'd be a problem, so there's still a concern, but you also, you know, you have agency and control. Knowing that not everybody's going to go start a Laracasts, but also having said things in the past, you've talked about how 9-to-5 doesn't work for everybody. You've talked about how college doesn't work for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have any advice that you would give to the, you know, the myriad PHP and Laravel developers who are listening to this right now that might help them explore maybe a little bit less traditional ways of kind of like doing our jobs?
Sure. It's difficult, right? Because what makes sense for somebody may not make sense for other people. Mm-hmm. So I think some people very much thrived in college. And they consider it one of the greatest decisions they made. Some people, I think, need that 9-to-5 job. Other people, it doesn't work for them. So it's a very difficult thing. It all comes back to personality, which we've talked about. The 4-hour workday for anyone. So Matt's given me a little trash over this. So I recorded a podcast a long time ago, right when I had a baby, and I was experimenting with this idea of 2 hours, two times. So the idea was like right when my baby was born. For anyone who has kids, it's very hard. It's very hard.
It's very hard.
And because I ran my own business, it wasn't like I could just say, okay, I'm taking 3 months off. Because if I take 3 months off, there's nobody there to respond to your support request. So I tried, I took 2 weeks off, but then beyond that, I was trying to do a little bit. So I was experimenting with this idea of 2 hours, two times, of where I would take 2 hours in the morning and really focus. No social media, no Telegram, nothing. Just serious focus for a full 2 hours. And it's actually amazing what you can get done in a two-hour span if you're seriously focusing, when most people don't. Most people, you do a little bit, and then suddenly we're talking on Telegram, and that's 10 minutes, and you're like, oh, God, I got to get back to work. But my idea was doing that two different times, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And my hope was that 4 hours total, if you really focus, can equal the 7 or 8 hours that most people do.
Right.
In hindsight, probably not. But
I love it as an experiment. I love the fact that you're asking those questions.
Yeah. So, and you know what? I actually did get a lot. It was enough for that period when the baby was born where I really needed to focus a lot of my energy on the baby and, of course, my wife, who had a hard time. But it was a good experiment. And I think that's the important thing, is just to ask questions and change things up. The whole idea of a 9-to-5 or a Monday through Friday, somebody invented that not that long ago. Somebody decided, oh, this is optimal. We're going to have people do Monday through Friday, 8 hours a day. But it was just some guy who thought it up. That doesn't mean that's the rule. Some companies are now embracing 4-day work weeks where they have Friday, Saturday, Sunday off. Some are trying this idea of still 40 hours, but you do 10 hours a day, 4 days a week. So it's I like that people are experimenting with different ways. But I even notice some days, if I take a short day or something, I feel bad because I think, well, 9-to-5 is the
standard.
It's the standard. It's the responsible adult way. But I stopped at 2 o'clock and I'm a terrible person. And I have to remind myself, like, nope, you do the work that you need to do. And it is hard with the 9-to-5 with some people because it just depends on your job. But sometimes you got most of your work done by 3 or 4 o'clock, and then you see workers kind of just hanging for an hour, you know, they're sneaking social media in or something like that. Not sneaking, but you know what I mean, right? Where it's
absolutely,
they're filling in the time because they're
your
basically
too dead to actually do the work at the end of the day anyway. You're already thinking about the evening.
Right,
but you're
right.
But you're stuck there.
And I hate that too, because it's like, well, it should be, if you've done, like, we should have enough faith in the people who work for us that if they're done, they got everything they could, then they should go. But there's that thing like, I got to wait till 5 or I got to wait till 5:30 before I can go home, even though I was basically done at 4. That's a hard thing. I don't know how to deal with it. I just like that people are experimenting with different ways of doing things at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I mean, I love the idea that the 9-to-5 can get in the way for us to really be present for our families in the ways we want to be. And as someone who's been very vocally in support of the idea that, hey, I get up in the morning, I put on my dress clothes, I go to a remote office, you know, not at my house, and I work a 9-to-5 and I come home even though I don't have to. You know, I own the company and I'm a remote worker, so I don't have to. So I see a lot of value there. I'm very much the type that works for me. But even so, I still see the moments where, like, I, you know, miss something that happened with my son when he comes home from school in the middle of the day or whatever else. The good thing is that I have enough freedom that I just build that into it. And so I think one of the things I've found the most that maybe would go towards, hey, if you're working a 9-to-5, maybe one step in Jeffrey's direction is like seeing if you can split up the day a little bit. You know, my wife really wanted to go back and take acting classes for a while. So for a while there, every Tuesday and Thursday or something like that, I came home at 10 a.m., and took care of my son for a while my wife went off to school. She came back home and then I worked, and I just worked an extra hour and a half at the end of the day or something. And not only was that, you know, like, cool for her to be able to do that, but actually I found that splitting up the day that way was actually really interesting in my focus. And so that's why I love what you're talking about. You're like, can I actually focus more by doing basically a 2-hour Pomodoro twice a day?
Exactly. Yeah.
And if anybody hasn't heard about Pomodoro, just go Google Pomodoro. I'll put in the show notes, but it's the same kind of thinking of like, your brain can't be full focus for 8 hours straight, right? And that's what I took the most away from what you were saying, at least with that, is you're just not going to be that
designed that way.
Right. That's cool. All right. Well, my gosh, I can't believe how much longer I could talk, but I've been swearing to try and keep these close to an hour. Are there parts of your story or your motivation or your day to day that kind of you feel like we haven't gotten a touch on yet?
No, I think we covered most of it, actually. So
like
short of getting into unrelated things like politics, which we don't want to do, I think we're good.
I will throw out one thing and you can respond to this or not. I think that Jeffrey is one of my favorite people to talk politics with because he does not put up with partisan solutions in either direction. Yeah. And he does have his own opinions, but he's loath to let them be known too much because he's too busy poking holes in both sides of the partisan. And I like it. I try to be as mid-level as I can be, but as someone who's really interested in like social justice and stuff, I'll lean a little left at times. And broaching any of those topics in a conversation with Jeffrey's there, I'm confident that he's not going to let me sit there with an unexamined position. So I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but I appreciate that.
I think you and I agree far more than you give us credit for. But,
well, no, we do, but you're a good devil's advocate, if nothing else, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even that we disagree, but you push things to be examined, and I appreciate that a lot about you.
Good, thank you. Appreciate that. This was fun. I had a lot of fun doing this.
Me too. Any shout-outs? Go to lyricasts.com, go shine up. He's also got, like, a billion other ones. There's viewcasts.com. And
it's all the same.
It all ends up at Lyricast.
I buy custom domain names for main series that I'm trying to promote. Mm-hmm. So you can go to viewcast.com, but it's just going to Lyricast. So all you need to remember is Lyricast.com. Check it out.
I like it. Jeffrey, this was a ton of fun. I tell this to everybody, and it's true every time. I could talk for another 2 hours and enjoy it.
It's amazing how quickly it goes by.
I know. Blowing my mind. Jeffrey, thanks for your time.
Thank you, man.
This was a ton of fun.